KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
While it's easier than ever to access information these days, it's also easier to access misinformation. Traditional news outlets are facing competition from newer forms of content creation, and not everyone follows the same rules. Today on Talk of Alaska, we'll talk about the role of local news and media literacy, and how to think critically about the content you're watching, reading, or listening to. Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, marking 47 years of commitment to operating the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
Did you know 100 years ago, the chances of a baby dying in Alaska before their first birthday was almost 10%? Because of advances in public health like sanitation, access to clean water, vaccines for children, and access to health care in rural communities, the chances of dying are now less than 1%. To learn more about what the Alaska Department of Health is doing to improve Alaskans' health for the next 100 years, visit health.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
Public media loves being part of your day. Thank you for listening and for your support. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Good morning. You're listening to Talk of Alaska on Alaska Public Media. I'm host Wesley Early, and we're here to discuss misinformation, local news, media literacy, and all things to think about when you're engaging with media, local news, journalism, all things of that nature. And I have a wonderful batch of guests today. We've got Andrew Kitchenman here in studio. Andrew is the managing editor of the Alaska Beacon, which I just found out today is like the 3-year anniversary of when Andrew accepted the job to manage the Beacon. Andrew, thanks so much for joining us.
Happy Mardi Gras.
We've got Paula Banquero also in the studio. Paula is a journalism professor. She was actually the chair of journalism when I went to UAA, and she teaches media literacy courses. And full disclosure, she's on Alaska Public Media's board of directors. Paula, thank you so much for being here.
Nice to be here.
And in Juneau, through the magic of radio, we have Larry Pursley, who's a longtime journalist and the owner of the Wrangell Sentinel, and he's the board chair of the Alaska News Coalition. Larry, thanks so much for being available.
Happy to be here.
And you listening to the radio can also participate in our conversation. You can give us a call here at 907-550-8422 in Anchorage. Statewide, the number is 1-800-478-8255. And if you'd like to send us an email, you can send it to talk@alaskapublic.org. So just to get things started, I really wanted to talk about the news landscape in Alaska, you know, giving people a sense of what's available in terms of local news. Andrew, can you just sort of describe what the Alaska Beacon does and how you sort of operate in the state?
We're a online, we describe ourselves as an outlet, so we're a website, but we're also a service that has our stories republished by other media in Alaska, including newspapers and public radio and TV and commercial radio also use our stories for their websites.
And it's part of this sort of national news outlet called States Newsroom?
Yes. We haven't really had it so much in Alaska, but in the last 15 or so years across the country, there's been a phenomenon of a growth in state government-focused nonprofit news outlets. And a bunch started about 15 years ago, and they ran into a problem in terms of a lot of them in terms of fundraising and getting the sort of business side of things right. And I think States Newsroom learned from that. They were able to secure some really large national support to launch state-specific sites across the country. And so it launched almost 7 years ago and has grown and grown. It's now has a presence in 39 states and has partners in the other 11. We were the 27th state. We launched on May 11th of 2022. We basically exist due to the support of people who believe in the value of independent journalism, whether that is the large national support that State's Newsroom has received or the really important support from Alaskans. And I think more and more that you're seeing that across journalism is we have to make the case to Alaskans of the value of the work we do, and then they support us through subscriptions or donations or memberships.
And Larry, you own the Wrangell Sentinel. You've owned it for a few years now. Can you talk about how your model is a little different? You both operate local news, but the Sentinel's a little different.
Well, we don't really both operate local news. The Alaska Beacon does a good job of covering state issues, but local news, you're talking about the little newspaper in Cordova or Nome or Kenai, Homer, Wrangell, Skagway, the radio stations, and that's a different world because there are no national funders underwriting the day-to-day operating expenses of those little newspapers, many of which are losing money. Wrangell loses money, and we've got to figure out, is there a way to, I don't want to say subsidize, but there's got to be a different way to run the businesses in those local communities, or the more of the papers are going to go away. There hasn't been a paper in Seward for years, hasn't been a paper in Valdez for years, and others are in jeopardy, and we've got to figure something out, which is the purpose of the Alaska News Coalition.
Yeah, can you talk a little about what the Alaska News Coalition does?
Well, we hope a lot. the idea is to look for different ways of going ahead, shared content between the newspapers, and trying to help the small communities, the small newspapers transition, though I hate the word transition, but transition to the digital world, which many of us are not very adept at. We also are working on a project to preserve public notices from government agencies in newspapers. It's like our last source of ad revenue left. So we're focused more on the business end of it, trying to find a way to keep the newspapers alive in the small towns. And because without it, you're not going to have anyone at City Hall covering school board meetings, covering high school basketball games.
You know, and I'm really interested you mentioned the public notices, because one thing that I've noticed in recent years is, especially with the advent of social media, you know, I didn't work in journalism, you know, 20, 30 years ago, but the idea was that government agencies kind of needed news outlets to get information out there, whether you're a police department, a fire department, you know, the governor. But now that news outlet or governments kind of control their own media, they can put it out themselves. Do you find it difficult to convince certain agencies that, no, you should still talk to us?
Well, that's sort of a two-part question. Yes, it's difficult to get a lot of government officials to talk to us because their attitude is, I don't have to talk to you, I'll just post my one-sided presentation on X or what's the other one? Facebook, you know, or Instagram or TikTok or something. But in terms of public notices, that's advertising. You know, that's a source of revenue we desperately need and which is important to the public. When are meetings going to be held? When are projects going to be bid out? When are zoning changes going to affect your neighborhood? So we're really fighting for that to preserve that mechanism for the public to know what government is doing.
And I understand, sort of from a wider perspective, I understand that this is kind of inside baseball. You know, we're all journalists talking about journalism. But, you know, I'd love to hear from each of you sort of why you see there's still a benefit of local news, why having sort of an independent verifier to verify information is still important. And, you know, Paola, as somebody who teaches journalism, you know, what do you, what's your selling point to people? Why is journalism still important?
Well, I think I start always with the premise that the founders thought that journalism was important, right? They put the press in the First Amendment for a reason, and that was because we needed then, and we still need an informed citizenry, and that informed citizenry becomes informed by by reading or consuming good coverage about those in power. And that comes really from the ways in which standards-based journalism is conducted. And so organizations like the Alaska Beacon, organizations like Alaska Public Media conform to standards which a lot of people who purport to provide information don't do. They verify their information. They are accountable for that information. And then they're independent of any, not only a political party, but independent of powerful forces, be they corporate or otherwise, that influence that news and information.
I'd like to get to the phones. We have Stu in Muldoon. Stu, thanks so much for joining the program.
Thank you. Fake news, false news. I have to point out a difference. I was here in Muldoon when Mayor Bronson had all the homeless at Centennial Campground, and there was an officer shot. I heard the shots. It was shocking. It sounded to me like an automatic weapon, but it was multiple pistols. I reported online, hey, we had an automatic weapon fire in Centennial Campground, and one of our representatives in Juneau picked up on it and repeated me, and then it turned out it was a bunch of, you know, it was multiple weapons being fired at once, and they criticized the guy for it. So, you know, it was rapid news, I understand, but I have to say, guys, there's, when you don't have a newspaper for people to read, the rumor mill goes crazy. And in talking to my neighbors, I don't know where they get their ideas. They accuse one of their neighbors of paying for a dumpster, which is next to the park for the homeless people, and people are upset. Next thing you know, someone shoots at her house. It's just without people knowing what the facts are, the crazy stuff they're repeating at the local level is just kind of frightening. And without a newspaper and without something to point at, especially election time, which is coming up, people start creating these crazy rumors, and a lot of people believe it. And I'm not sure what to do, but I've observed it, and they don't even know who owns what property when it comes to dedicated parks. If someone said, oh, we're going to develop it. Well, it's a dedicated park. It doesn't get developed. You know, things like that, basics. And there's a lot of confusion, and because of it, stress in the community without having a paper for people to get cleared up on. Yeah. That's just my observation.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great observation as to sort of the, I think there's sort of two forces there, right? There's the speed at which information both gets out, and I think that we expect to get information, you know, because all of us have computers in our pockets that it can give us instantaneous information. There's an expectation that we get things quickly, but also it takes time to verify things, and so those things can kind of be in conflict. You know, I think, Andrew, you are probably the least time removed from daily journalism is of the guests that we have, minus me. You know, can you talk about that process of, you know, you hear about something, you can't necessarily report on a rumor, but the process from hearing about something and that verification?
Well, I mean, I think in certain ways, all the news media now is in the position with our websites of, you know, we are a website, but newspapers and public radio also have websites. So we're all in a position to report on things quickly. Yeah, I mean, we want to verify it, ideally from multiple sources, independent sources. We consider the sort of position of the sources to be in a position of authority to be able to say what's factual or not. I mean, you do see often after natural disasters, even official sources will put out information because they're trying to manage the same challenge of meeting the demand of the public for information and also to be factual, and sometimes they have information that's wrong, but we want to be very careful, and that's the reason that, you know, there are times where even when journalists get information from official sources, they still need to try to double check it. And yeah, it's that independence of judgment that is really central to the value we bring. And I mean, a point I wanted to make that kind of unifies points that Larry and Paula made is that the founding fathers, from the very beginning, in addition to having the First Amendment, They also subsidized the media in the same way that public notices subsidized the media, mainly through the Postal Service, that at that point, distribution was one of the biggest costs of putting out a newspaper. And by allowing greatly subsidized rates, they made it affordable and accessible. At that point, it was well before like the penny press, and newspapers were really expensive, but they would get handed around to like 50 people.
Yeah. You know, and that kind of brings the discussion over independence of media really brings me to kind of a recent topic. You know, the White House recently announced that they would choose who participates in the press pool, which is for the layman, the group of reporters who cover the White House, instead of the independent White House Correspondents Association. I'm curious, and Larry, maybe we'll start with you. How do you think that, you know, a government agency stepping in and deciding who covers them, how does that impact the independence of news outlets?
Well, it guts it. I mean, certainly letting the White House pick who reports, who's into the room is distressing, despicable, depressing. It's just not the way it should be. But the litany of changes the Trump administration has made, this is one of many, so it's not surprising. Hell, I'm not surprised he doesn't charge him rent to come into the press conference.
You know, and I'm curious, when we talk about independence, maybe we should take a step back as like independence of media. I think that, you know, that, you know, maybe people might scoff at that because organizations like the Beacon are funded by large organizations. Even Alaska Public Media is funded by organizations that sometimes we have to cover. You know, Paula, how do you discuss independence when you're talking to students, and like why it's important and what it is?
Well, we prepare people in our department to be both in journalism and then in public communications or in strategic communications. And so it's important for all of those students to understand that news has to be produced that's free of it's free of the influence, but it can be supported by corporations. It can be supported by independent donors. It can be supported by people who buy ads. It can be supported by people who see those ads and then go and buy a car at Lithia or whatever. And so I try to distinguish for students what the difference is between how it's supported and then whether it is influenced or controlled by that organization or by that political party or by that corporation. So we talk a lot about how, you know, ConocoPhillips could have a newsletter and everything in that newsletter is going to be ConocoPhillips's perspective. And that is completely legitimate for ConocoPhillips to do, but that is not news. That's a form of strategic communications. But news is something that is independent of the influence or oversight of ConocoPhillips, although ConocoPhillips might be a corporate sponsor of Alaska Public Media.
Yeah, and you know, I think that that line between you mentioned earlier, and I tried to mention at the top, that like there are newer forms of media in the world than there were when it was just sort of newspapers, radio stations, TV stations, and there aren't a set of what you called standards that everybody follows. You know, if I'm a TikTok influencer who's maybe really concerned about the police department or maybe the missing and murdered Indigenous crisis, maybe I'm very anti-transgender people, right? Like, you can have all of these various perspectives and you're pushing it out, and somebody who's scrolling, it's not like there's a little notice that says, this is somebody's opinion, this is a good piece of all-American journalism, this is a strategic communication. So how do you even find the difference between what is like journalism and what is just sort of content? You know, I know that there are news outlets in Alaska that are explicitly paid for by political parties, but they show up on Google under news, right? So like, is it impossible to stretch them from that at this point?
It's a lot of practice. I mean, media literacy skills are not something you learn once and just go, oh, I'm media literate, and you walk away. You just have to keep learning because things change. Podcasts and, as you say, you know, the devices or the technology changes. And so you have to keep upping the ante about what you know about being literate and being able to distinguish, yeah, that's an ad, or, you know, just really, it can be 30 seconds. What is the purpose of this message? Who's produced it? Can I get to the bottom of maybe who's paid for it? Or the language they use. Are there a lot of ad hominem attacks? That might give you an indication that it's not adhering to the standards that do rule the day for organizations like Alaska Beacon or Associated Press.
Andrew, can you talk a little bit about, you know, how you walk that line, or is there a line for you? You know, is there, once a story sort of reaches a certain point, is it like, that is journalism, you know? So I think a lot of people used to think of it as like, you need to tell both sides of a story, you know, or you need to, you know, certain language isn't used.
Well, I think in general, journalists' highest obligation is to the truth. And so I think the way you get there is by presenting a lot of facts. So, you know, I think opinion journalism's valuable, and Larry does that. But what we're doing, and we actually have a commentary section, and that's opinion journalism. But what our new staff is doing is not opinion journalism, and so you don't hear those kind of value judgments in the reporting. What you experience is a series of facts, and that helps. You know, the goal here is to give the audience the information they need. It's not to tell you what to think. It's to give you the information you need to know what's happening in our case, in your state, in local media organizations, in your community.
And, you know, a lot of people they use the term bias a lot when they talk about journalism, when they talk about just individuals. And I think, personally, I think it's ridiculous to suggest that any individual reporter would be free of bias, right? Like, we all live our lives. There's the eight hours a day that you're working in journalism, but then you exist. But how do you sort of walk that line between acknowledging that people do have biases and making sure that it doesn't show up in their work? And Larry, we can start with you, because you kind of have worked both sides of that.
You need an editor. Everybody needs an editor, because as Andrew said, we all have biases, we all have preconceived notions, we all have subliminal grudges or something. So this the notion that you can write what you want and post it, you need that second set of, not just eyes, second brain. You need an editor to say, hey, Bill, I think this is a little too much, or Sally, you got to pull yourself out of this story. So I think having an editor who can step back, be less emotional, look at it and say, good reporting, good recitation of the facts, good writing, but you got a couple cases in here, you got to knock yourself out of the story. You're not allowed to say that.
Yeah, and one thing that I'm really curious about, and I'd love to hear your input, is I know that news outlets have changed a lot in recent decades. 100 years ago, newspapers were often the vessels by which very powerful people could sort of get their opinions across, get their sort of their priorities funded, and get their priorities sort of in front of a lot of people. And I think that news outlets have changed a lot in recent decades with, you know, there are a lot more women in journalism, there's a lot more members of underrepresented groups. I'm curious, and this is open for anybody, you know, do you feel like that's changed that purported sort of neutrality of mainstream news? I think it's really easy to be neutral about underrepresented groups when you have no underrepresented groups and there's nobody in your newsroom to go like, actually, that might be racist, you know, or actually, that's an antiquated statement. You know, how do you, as newsrooms become more representative, how do you sort of maintain that neutrality, or at least the perception?
I mean, I think that, you know, the broader a segment of a community you're interacting with, whether that's on your staff or who you cover, the closer you can get to the truth and to the facts, because you're going to hear that wider range of perspectives, and that's going to inform your reporting. So I think the news media, as it has incorporated a broader range of views, has gotten more factual, because in the past, you know, it wasn't being as factual. I'm not a huge person on the word objective. I don't have a godlike view of the media, but I do believe in, you know, being truthful and factual and fair, and interacting with people and talking to officials and non-officials and as many people as you can helps keep you honest. And I think one thing that helps all the traditional media and, in our case, the Beacon, is that we do survive by virtue of the people who pay for us. And newspapers, even as they aren't as big as they used to, still have many subscribers, and public radio has many members. And, they let you know when they're unhappy, and when you're reaching a really broad segment of the community, I think that does help keep you honest.
And, you know, I'm happy you brought up sort of people, the idea that your readers can sort of drive your coverage and sort of what's important. One thing that I often wonder about is, you know, there's a difference between maybe a news reporter being biased and somebody not liking that somebody they admire is being portrayed in maybe a negative light. Like, how do you balance that? Well, you know, it's against the law to do this. Just because this person did this and they're a member of a political party, it doesn't mean that we're biased going after them. Like, how do you combat that perception of, you know, it can seem sometimes that the media is just going after one side?
Well, I think it's important to hold, both sides or all sides, if there's more than two parties or more than two politicians in a race, to hold everyone accountable and to apply standards of truthfulness and fact-checking to all candidates. I think that is a way of showing bias, is to only pursue one side. Now, you know, you also don't want to be in a position of, oh, we cover everybody equally in terms of equal time, so that if a politician is not truthful, you know, they're guaranteed to have that equal space. Our first obligation is to the truth, but I think we have to be really, really careful in our independence that we're not serving the interest. People think of it often in terms of negative coverage of politicians, but, you know, we don't have our jobs to serve the interests of any politicians or any political parties.
Larry, is there anything you wanted to add?
No, I think it's, as Andrew said, it's important to be put out the truth. But I think one problem some journalists have is they feel if they have a statement from one party, one side of an issue, they have to get a statement from the other side. Even if that other statement is factually inaccurate, our job is to print what's accurate, what's truthful, what is not misleading. And if one side of an argument doesn't have anything that meets such criteria, I don't feel any obligation to give them equal time.
Are you ever sort of concerned that then someone can point at you and say, oh, look, see, Larry doesn't care about our side. Larry doesn't care about our perspective, the perspective that voters voted for?
Not on the news pages. I certainly have lost subscribers in Wrangell because they don't care for the editorial page. Seems a week doesn't go by I don't lose somebody, but I've never had anyone say the news stories are unfair. Now, I will say a lot of the public doesn't know a news story from an editorial, from an opinion page, from an op-ed, from an ad. To them, it's all something they saw on their phone and they said, oh, did you see that? They don't know what they see or the context. So we've got to be careful to really make clear what's news, what's opinion, but I think the public has lost sight. To them, it's all something on their screen.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll have a lot more to talk about after our break. As Talk of Alaska continues, please stay tuned.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Talk one-on-one with experts on mental health, nutrition, pharmacology, surgery, childcare, and much more on Line One, your health connection. Join our hosts as they discuss the health topics that matter to Alaskans with their guests and live callers. Email questions before, during, or after the live broadcast to line1@alaskapublic.org. That's Line One, your health connection, weekly on your local public radio station.
And we are back. This is Talk of Alaska on Alaska Public Media. I'm Wesley Early. Today, the topic is identifying misinformation and understanding local news. And with me today is Andrew Kitchenman and Paola Banchero here in studio. We've got Larry Persley in Juneau. If you would like to join our conversation, give us a call in Anchorage. The phone number is 907-550-8422. Around the state, you can call 1-800-478-8255. And you can also send emails to talk@alaskapublic.org. So before we took the break, we were talking a lot about sort of public perception of news versus what news actually does. And, you know, Larry, you mentioned this sort of this distinction between opinion pieces and traditional news. I'm curious, as somebody who writes op-eds pretty frequently, both locally and, I feel like I see one from you in the ADN about once a month. How do you see opinions, which are sort of the, I wouldn't say the opposite of news journalism, but it serves a different purpose than straight up news journalism. How do you see that fitting in a wider media landscape?
Well, I guess as I think of the wider media landscape, as you call it that way, now it's more opinion than it is news. I mean, all the bloggers and influencers and all those other people who are online, they're not generally, well, most of them aren't journalists. They're just people with opinions or people who see an opportunity to make money. So I think it's, traditional media, if you want to call it that, mainstream media, if you want to call it that, I think it's important, increasingly important, to label it clearly, and not just a little label, but to make it obvious, hit people over the head, you're reading news or you're reading opinion. And generally, you should not have someone who's covering the news also write opinion, because that blurs the line and confuses the reader or listener.
And, you know, I think in recent years we've seen this sort of this silo that people exist in. You know, there are sort of social media channels that people are maybe more likely to read, you know, because of their own personal beliefs. There are algorithms that social media sort of uses to say, oh, well, you like this, you'll also like this and this. And soon everybody's individual algorithm has siloed them off. And so now if you don't see, like, there are probably large news stories that you're just not seeing because your particular silo isn't covering that. You know, how do you break through the silo? And I guess maybe, Andrew, it's a good question for you as somebody who sort of is the managing editor of a newsroom that purports to sort of not serve a particular silo but serve everybody. How do you break through that?
Well, I think one thing that I like is the fact that The Beacon is republished by so many media, basically allows me to think in terms of the public as being all Alaskans. And so the audience that we're trying to reach. And so it's a pretty traditional approach to news. I mean, defining your audience is really important in a business model. And, you know, since some of our primary customers are the editors and news directors of the other media in the state, I try to think, well, they all have large audiences. So that's what I'm trying to reach in terms of recognizing that there are barriers to that. I mean, it's interesting. I sometimes think that people who only, for instance, follow media that's critical of traditional media are still getting a lot of actual information secondhand, because a lot of what those other critical media do is, in the course of criticizing them, they'll repeat the news that they've reported. So even then, I think... you know, and then also some people are able to make adjustments, and they sort of know, even if they're seeking out sort of highly opinionated sources, you know, I don't want to sound naive. Many people don't know that, but many people are able to kind of adjust. Well, okay, I'm hearing this from a highly opinionated source, and I may like that source, but I also may recognize that there may be a difference between where they stand and what the pure facts are.
Yeah, it's like if you're watching Fox News and you have it on all day, there's a difference between what Sean Hannity and what The Five are talking about, and there's a difference between what their newscasts are talking about. Although, do you find that distinction is often clear? Maybe Fox News is, I don't want to seem like I'm nitpicking, you know, MSNBC obviously has their people who provide content, and it's sometimes
I think you should just avoid all of those, actually.
Really?
I don't mean avoid. Maybe I should say, think about your diet, you know? Do you want to eat Legos for breakfast with a lot of, you know, fake maple syrup? Or do you want to eat, like, something nutritious, you know, oatmeal? And so that's my metaphor, you know? I think, you know, fill up on stuff like the Alaska Beacon, you know, Associated Press, and responsible standards-based organizations. And then sprinkle your diet, if you want, with some opinion.
With some Legos?
Yeah. Well, not Legos, with Eggos.
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 I see.
Yeah. So sprinkle your diet with a little bit of opinion, and I think you'll find yourself feeling a lot better about the world, actually.
That actually brings us into an email we got from Ken. He says, I think we can all agree that having corporations fund journalism is less than ideal. It is a big ask when, for example, NPR accepts money from corporations and broadcasts their messages and then assure us that they, quote, cover them like they cover anyone else. I'm not buying it. I know it takes money to do journalism, and I don't have any answers as to how you're going to get a public that expects all their news to be free, to dig into their wallets and pay for the service. Frankly, I think it's a lost cause, at least in this country. How important is it that people pay for their own journalism? I guess, do you think that if people paid for their journalism, they wouldn't need corporate support? Larry, can I start with you as sort of the dangers of corporations and corporate funding, as someone who relies almost exclusively on subscribers?
Yeah, I wish I had a corporate funding or any funding. And speaking just about newspapers here, if newspapers had to depend only on subscribers, you couldn't do it. You know, there was a guy once who was upset about something we wrote, and he accused me of using the story, using the headline as clickbait to sell more newspapers. And I told him, Wayne, I lose money on every paper I sell. Why do I want to sell more? That's a stupid comment from him. Anyway, so in the traditional older days, newspapers would get maybe two-thirds, three-quarters of their revenue from advertising and the rest from subscriptions. Well, that's changed because the advertisers, the real estate ads, the classified ads, the department stores, furniture stores, they no longer exist. So we're having, in the newspaper world, transition into charging the readers more because there's just no advertising left. There's a limit how much advertisers will pay. You know, will they pay $50, $60, $80 a year? At some point, you reach the threshold where they say it's just not worth it, and we're going to have to go find some other funding for it.
We have another caller coming in. Jacob is calling from Anchorage. Jacob, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Wesley. Hey, I just wanted to comment. One of the reasons that I've always been an NPR listener is the fact that news and information is typically presented in a way that's dispassionate, that gives an opportunity for the listener to take that information and process it themselves. And I think you guys were already kind of on this topic, but you don't get that from a lot of the mainstream news sources, quote unquote. A lot of it is often presented, this is how you should feel, and this is why you should feel this way.
And when you say, so your suggestion is that people in news are sort of saying, they're taking information and they're saying, here's how you should feel about it?
I guess more or less, yeah. You know, if you're listening to a newscaster or presenter who's already angry about a topic, you're not really getting information, you're getting the feeling, and you're getting the why you should feel this way, if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, I think that goes back to the balance, and maybe someone else can jump in about the difference, the clear difference between what is a commentary and what is straight up news.
And there's also, I think, a difference between national news and local news, and I'll include the Beacon just in terms of it's not national, in that every national politics are so polarized that it's very challenging to even describe facts in such a way that using language that everyone will agree is the language that describes the facts, because the language has become so polarized nationally. That's much, much less true in Alaska, to some extent at a state level and certainly at a local level. And so when you get your news from local sources, I think you're much less likely to run into this issue of news sources that are only serving a certain audience, which can affect that. I think, you know, you can do some research on the business models of news media. The Beacon has a State's Newsroom, our parent, has a website where they list everyone who's ever given us $1,000 or more, which isn't that much. I mean, if you've given, I think, $8 or $9 a week since the Beacon has launched, then you would be on that list. And so we're transparent in that way. But I also think it's helpful to keep in mind that news reporters and often news managers don't really know much about, directly who is, for instance, the largest advertisers or the largest
underwriters.
Yeah, foundations. And so in my career, I've had very little awareness, and I would say in certain ways almost less awareness now that I'm a manager, because of the uniqueness of State's Newsroom, as to who's paying for the news. So I think part of why people get upset is they hear journalists say, oh, we none of this matters. And they know it matters. And so it undermines our credibility. I would just say that people tend to overrate how much it matters. I'm being truthful when I say I don't have knowledge of, for instance, the largest foundations. I know that they're on the list that's publicly available. And it just doesn't motivate, that's not why people get into this business. And I think, less credible sources really are driven by who fund them. And that's why it pays to seek out those sources that aren't. I think it's unfortunate in certain ways that we get our national news from national outlets. I'm a big fan of Liz Ruskin and the role she plays in that she covers national news from an Alaska perspective. And she's an Alaskan, and I think that was the older model, when newspapers had Washington bureaus, and it was a pretty good one. And I think one of the reasons why we've become so divided as a country is because we get our sources from this highly, highly polarized and divided, level of government.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to add to that, and that the hollowing out of local news, as Larry has described, makes people focus less on the local, less on what's happening in Muldoon or in Wrangell, and more on the national news. And then that becomes, it colors everything. They think everything is like what the national political structure is like, and it's not. Alaska is quite different, and so are many other states. We don't necessarily reflect what's happening on a partisan level at the national level.
Yeah, one of the things, and I've worked in journalism for under 10 years, so when I started learning about journalism, it was already kind of like everything's on fire. It's not going to be as good as it was 20 years ago. Was there a quote-unquote golden age of journalism? Like, what did newsrooms look like when they could afford to, have a Washington bureau, when they could afford to have more than one reporter? Most of the public radio stations around the state have one single reporter. I imagine a lot of the newspapers run into similar issues. How was that different from now? Anybody.
I think partly it's that there existed in metropolitan areas monopolies. So the Dallas Morning News was the monopoly in Dallas, and it could afford to send a correspondent to Mexico City, and it could afford to send a correspondent to Washington, D.C. And so you got news from both places that was colored to what the Dallas audience wanted. That doesn't exist anymore because Dallas Morning News is doesn't have that monopoly because there are many other news organizations, or you know, there's things that aren't news but people think they are, that are competing for that, for that news dollar and then attention.
And you know, I'm curious, as we're sort of moving into the now where there is a lot of misinformation, there's also disinformation. I'm wondering, Paula, could you explain the difference there between something that's misinformation and disinformation?
Yeah, I think many times scholars use those terms somewhat interchangeably, but misinformation is kind of the inadvertent sharing of false information, and disinformation is the intentional distribution, creation of false information.
And there's money in that second one.
Yes, there's money, and there's also power to be gained by misleading people.
So we're going to take our next break. You're listening to Talk of Alaska. The topic is misinformation and local news.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Did you know 100 years ago, the chances of a baby dying in Alaska before their first birthday was almost 10%? Because of advances in public health like sanitation, access to clean water, vaccines for children, and access to health care in rural communities, the chances of dying are now less than 1%. To learn more about what the Alaska Department of Health is doing to improve Alaskans' health for the next 100 years, visit health.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
Get your weekly look at the trends, policies, and issues that impact your wallet in Alaska with the Alaska Economic Report. From local businesses to fiscal policy to big industries like fishing, tourism, and oil and gas, I'll cover the high-stakes economic issues that matter to Alaskans all over the state. That's the Alaska Economic Report with me, Ava White, on your local public radio station each week.
Want to make a lasting impression? Consider planning a gift as a bequest to this station. Talk to a financial advisor to learn how.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Our topic is identifying misinformation and understanding local news. We're here with Andrew Kitchenman, Paula Banchero, and Larry Pursley. And if you're just tuning in, we spent a lot of the initial part of this show talking about sort of what local news does, what challenges exist, the difference in just the market for journalism, how it's much different today than it used to be. I'd like to spend this last little bit of time talking about, what do we do about it? What are the solutions? Are we stuck? And one of the first things I really want to talk about is, as local news outlets move into the future, you know, there are new ways to interact with people. So I guess, how well do you think journalists are doing at meeting people where they are? You know, whether it's social media, doing community call-outs. I just saw that ProPublica rented a bus. They, like, rented a billboard bus in front of a government agency that said, were you just laid off? Call us. You know, do you think journalists are adapting?
Well, yes. I mean, we've all been on social media. I mean, a big source of the former Twitter, a big source of why it rose was that a lot of journalists were on it, and that was a good source for news. It doesn't necessarily play the same role anymore. I ultimately want to inform people. So if it became absolutely clear that the entire public was on TikTok and everyone had stopped reading, I because I believe in journalism, I would probably go there. It's not you know, as clear to me right at the moment that will be the case. I think there's enormous potential. You know, I think one way that people can deal with these problems is by subscribing to their local newspaper and being a member of their public radio station and potentially mm-hmm. considering making a donation to the Alaska Beacon. In this golden age, you know, I think newspaper subscriptions peaked in the late 80s. And, you know, we didn't have the internet then. And there were certain tools for information that didn't exist. And so, yeah, there was more news available in terms of content produced by journalists. It was a better time to be a journalist in terms of pay and benefits. But there's still enormous potential with the internet. that has sort of opened up democracy in certain ways, and there have been negative consequences in certain ways so far. But I still think looking forward to the future, that good journalism can really accomplish a lot. And it's going to be a partnership between, you know, the broad public and the people who have the privilege to be journalists.
Larry, so what do you think? Do you think the Rango Sentinel is going to be on TikTok anytime soon?
No, not if I own it.
How do you see, sort of as a local news owner, you know, what is the solution for you? If you know that you aren't going to get enough subscribers in Wrangell, which is a community of, what, maybe 3,000 people?
2,000 and shrinking.
2,000 and shrinking, right? So, like, even if everybody paid $25 a year, you could maybe support one reasonable reporter salary. You know, what is the solution to sort of meet people where they are if people in Wrangell maybe aren't as tuned into the local newspaper?
Well, if I knew that, I wouldn't be losing so much money. But that's what I'm trying to figure out. Is there a way? You can't cut your expenses so much that you can't send reporters or a reporter to the basketball game or the city hall. So it's looking at how to squeeze more out of things, how to use local people who may be able to write a little bit to cover some community news, looking at charging more up to the level that people will pay for subscriptions for the paper. I think the problem, and we haven't really touched on it as yet, is a large portion of, and I'll just talk about America, a large portion of the American public just doesn't want to make time anymore in their day to read news or listen to news or watch news. They get enough information to run their lives off their phones. The fact that, hey, maybe you should make some time in the evening, in the afternoon, in the morning to read, listen, watch real news as opposed to scrolling with your thumbs. We've lost a lot of people, and I don't know how we get them back. And if we don't get them back, there's just not enough customers out there.
Yeah, and Paola, as you're talking to students who, you know, I'm about just under 10 years removed from going to college, but, you know, arguably the issue's gotten worse in the last 10 years as far as, you know, I imagine it's a lot harder for somebody who comes into journalism and says, I want to work for a newspaper. It's like, well, it's not going to be like it was maybe when you thought you wanted to be in newspapers.
Yeah, I don't think students have any... I don't think they have any dreams of working for newspapers for the most part. The good thing, I think, is, okay, so trust in media is at a very low point. We have no place to go but up. And so that's a good message for students. Like, you can build a better media ecosystem. It's not that it's reliant entirely on this generation, but they can help build more trust in media. And I think students are excited by that prospect.
And, you know, what are sort of the strengths in having nowhere to go but up? You know, do you think that people who were so used to, was there like a media bubble? And now that it's burst, everybody has to kind of change? And do you think that newer journalists, younger journalists, the next generation of journalists have an advantage?
Yeah, I think a lot of them have more of a social entrepreneurship kind of perspective that's going to help them build organizations like The Beacon, or build networks that are more powerful for the future.
And I'm curious, you know, and Andrew, you touched a lot about, you know, how The Beacon is almost by design a collaborative news, collaborative in the sense that you provide news to others and you partner. But I'm curious, where do you see collaboration between newsrooms moving forward? And do you think that it's kind of the way to go?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the AP, the Associated Press, might be a model in certain ways for the future. I mean, the AP itself is struggling, but the idea of sharing information is, I think, helpful. In our case, if you're a really good local organization, you can draw from the Beacon's coverage and share that with your local audience.
I'd like to talk. I'd like to end on optimism. You know, obviously, all of us are invested in journalism continuing to exist. Larry, I'll start with you. How optimistic are you that journalism will survive? That even maybe more specifically, that the Wrangell Sentinel will survive?
Well, I think journalism will survive. I think it will be on a smaller scale. We've lost several thousand newspapers in this country in recent years. We're going to lose more. So I guess I hope that when it settles out, that will the papers, radio stations, TV, whatever, that survive will be stronger, but we're not going to be able to save them all.
Andrew, how optimistic are you about the future of journalism?
I think if I wasn't optimistic at all, I wouldn't be doing it. I think that it's so essential to democracy that if democracy is going to have a future, then some form of journalism is going to have a future. If we don't have democracy, we'll maybe have bigger problems than not knowing what's going on.
And Paola, as someone who's helping sort of foster the next generation of journalism, you know, maybe you're seeing it on the ground level. How optimistic are you?
I'm optimistic, actually. I think that we are actually seeking connection. And I think a lot of people are dispirited by the division in this country. And I do think that journalism plays an important role in rebuilding those connections.
How so?
I think by being transparent, being fair, being accurate, being truthful can help. And I think a lot of it is explaining to people that you're not always going to like what you consume. You're not going to always like what you see or what you read, but that it's essential for the things you care about to function.
Yeah, I always thought of journalism as an inherently optimistic field, which is that if you just put the truth out there, if you let people know what's going on, they will make the right decision, they will make the responsible decision for democracy. Well, we're just about out of time. This has been Talk of Alaska on Alaska Public Media. The topic today was identifying misinformation and understanding local news. We had in studio in Anchorage, Andrew Kitchiman, who is the editor-in-chief of the Alaska Beacon, which will soon celebrate its 3-year anniversary. We had Paola Banquero, who's a UAA journalism professor who specifically teaches courses on media literacy. And in Juneau, through the magic of radio, we had Larry Pursley, who's a longtime Alaska journalist, the owner of the Wrangell Sentinel, and the board chair of the Alaska News Coalition. Our engineer was Chris Hyde. Madeline Rose, as always, is our producer. Getting our phone calls today was Ava White. I'm Wesley Early in for Lori Townsend, and we will be back next week. Thanks for listening.
Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.
You are listening to 830 AM KSDP in Sandpoint, Alaska.
KSDP, 830 AM in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in False Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
It's time now for your weather, tide predictions, and sunrise and sunset. Starting with your coastal water forecast, courtesy of the National Weather Service of Anchorage, Alaska. From Sitka Knapp to Castle Cape, Small craft advisory tonight. Today, east winds 20 knots, seas 6 feet with rain. Tonight, southeast winds 30 knots, seas 8 feet with rain and snow. And Wednesday, south winds 20 knots, seas...